This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Pain and sorrow grip almost every word of Pope Francis's unprecedented letter to the world's Catholics. With shame and repentance, he wrote on Monday, we acknowledge as an ecclesial community that we did not act in a timely manner, realizing the magnitude and gravity of the abuse done to so many lives. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them. The letter comes after a weekend of fury in parishes across the United States after last week's report from a Pennsylvania grand jury describing systemic, grotesque sexual abuse almost unimaginable in scope and scale. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro reserved special condemnation for church leaders who covered up the abuse.
Church officials routinely and purposefully described the abuse as horseplay and wrestling and inappropriate contact. It was none of those things. It was child sexual abuse, including rape, committed by grown men, priests, against children.
Well, this hour on Point, Catholics confront the conspiracy in their church again. You can join us on air or online. Catholics across America, what is your reaction to Francis's letter? What does the Pennsylvania grand jury report tell you about the challenges still standing in the way of true change in this global, ancient, and powerful institution? What happened at Mass in your church this past Sunday? And for everyone else inside and outside the church, what do you make of this moment now? Is change possible for worldwide Catholicism? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. First, let's start in Rome today with Philip Pulella. He's Vatican correspondent for Reuters News Agency, and he joins us now. Phil, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So this letter that the Pope released yesterday, unprecedented is the only word I can think of. I mean, how did it, what was the response there in Rome, in the Vatican?
Well, we were all surprised. I mean, it is unprecedented in the sense that popes have written letters to the people of God, which is church speak for every Catholic, and some believe that it's actually beyond Catholics, also for other people who are non-Catholics, on the specific issue of sexual abuse. He wrote it rather quickly, feeling the weight of the Pennsylvania report. It came out last Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken. The Vatican didn't say anything for about 2 days, mm-hmm. which is, I guess, understandable if a report is 900 pages. And they did then come out with expressing shame and sorrow. But he obviously felt that that was not enough and wrote this unprecedented letter to every Catholic in the world. Addressed to every Catholic in the world on this topic, which is creating another crisis in the church 15, 17 years after Boston.
Well, so Phil, let me ask you though. I mean, the letter it feels incredibly heartfelt. He's speaking to the Catholics the world over, but does the Pope, the head of the church himself in this letter, make any promises for concrete change?
Well, he's basically repeating promises that he has made before in the past few years, vowing that cover-up will not happen again, that bishops will be held accountable. But he said these things before, as his papacy has progressed. He was elected in 2013. But the thing is snowballing now because he was basically blindsided by the situation in Chile where he defended this priest, this bishop rather, who then the Pope had to backtrack on that. And then all the Chilean bishops handed in their resignation. And then the Bishop of Adelaide in Australia had to resign because he was convicted of abuse by a civil jury. and then the Pennsylvania thing. So, it's just been one thing after the other in a short amount of time.
Can I just jump in here for a second, Phil? Because about that Chilean case, he was defending Bishop Barros, right, who had been accused of covering up abuse by another priest. And in fact, I mean, that was one of Francis's not most finest moments, right, because he accused victims of, quote-unquote, calumny against Barros. And that was, that was just this year. So has this gotten, you talked to Francis, you interviewed him directly, a little earlier this summer in June. I mean, in speaking to him one-on-one, do you get a sense that this cascade of catastrophes has gotten beyond him? Or what is his genuine feeling about this moment?
Well, I think his genuine feeling is pain and sorrow. I mean, he is a good man. I think that he has inherited a situation in the Catholic Church that obviously predated him, but that's not to make excuses or anything, because it is true that he could and should have perhaps taken stronger action to hold bishops accountable. Now, it must be said that many of these reports that come up, as terrible as they are really quite some time ago, and the Pennsylvania thing was like the past 70 years, okay? And since the U.S. Church put in new regulations after the Boston Spotlight stuff, there have not been many, many cases since then. But that's not, that's not to belittle anything. But critics want him to take action against bishops. So there are fewer cases of abuse now than there were in the 50s, in the 60s, when I was growing up, et cetera, when the church was trusted blindly, particularly by an immigrant community, the Irish, the Italian, et cetera. They went to work, left their kids, in churches, in schools, et cetera.
Phil, may I just jump in here? Because you said something that I want to ask you about. Yes, most of the cases, especially that we've seen in these grand jury reports, for example, were decades in the past. But there still remains the question of the current power structure of the church, right? Because, I've spoken with Marie Collins. She's a former member of Francis's Commission on the Protection of Minors, right? You know her very well. And one of the reasons why she stepped down is that she cited that members of the church were resistant to implementing the very changes that the commission was recommending, right? They wanted the Vatican to set up a tribunal to deal with bishops who act appropriately in these child sex abuse cases. But, that they were getting resistance from that within the Vatican. So I guess my question is, how do those, other than Francis, right below him, there's a powerful group of men in Vatican leadership. Are they seeing this moment as time for them to change as well?
Well, I think I know Mary Collins, and she's a very courageous woman. Inside the Vatican has always been very slow to realize, to recognize problems that are quote unquote far away from its walls. And there was for many years there was a sense of denial, particularly during John Paul's papacy. We don't talk about this. People are trying to smear us, particularly during John Paul, who grew up in Poland, and he thought that every time that people talked about sexual abuse, these were sort of like similar to the communist smear campaigns against the church in Poland. Right now, I would say that the Vatican is in a kind of a mini shell shock about what to do about this. There is obviously resistance from people who want to maintain power. If we go sort of, if the Vatican wants full bishop accountability, a lot of heads are going to have to roll, because a lot of these things took place, and this is what, as Spotlight and others found out, this is what happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s and on. You just moved them, and then and that was it. And that does not happen by itself. Right. That happens with bishops knowing about it, and many of these men are still alive.
Right.
And you could imagine that 34 bishops in Chile had to resign or offer their resignation as a kind of sign of penitence and leaving the Pope to then decide. I think there are 275 bishops in the United States. I mean, if everyone sort of had to sort of say, okay, we're all in a way guilty because we knew a little bit, blah, blah, blah. I mean,
right.
The institution would have to shut down.
Well, Philip, can I just take it back from you there, because you've given us
sure.
a lot to think about. That's Phil Pollella. He's the Vatican correspondent for Reuters News Agency, joining us from Rome today. Phil, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm going to introduce another guest here, but first I want to play a little bit more tape from the Pennsylvania Attorney General, Josh Shapiro, just to give you a sense as to what the grand jury there uncovered about the decades of abuse in various parishes in Pennsylvania. And just a little warning here. I mean, this is about horrific abuse. The tape that you're about to hear will probably be disturbing to some people. So it's about 17 seconds long. But here he is. Here's Josh Shapiro detailing an especially appalling story from a diocese in Pittsburgh.
One boy was forced to stand on a bed in a rectory, stripped naked, and pose as Christ on the cross for the priests. They took photos of their victim, adding them to a collection of child pornography, which they produced and shared on church grounds.
I mean, the sickening nature of that is reason enough to understand why there was so much anger in so many parishes at Sunday Mass this weekend. And joining us now to talk about that is Susan Reynolds. She's professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. She was the lead author of an open letter by Catholic theologians, parishioners, lay leaders, and more, calling on all U.S. bishops to offer their resignation in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report. We have a link to that letter at onpointradio.org. It's been signed by some 3,000 people. Susan Reynolds, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
So we've just got a minute to go here before the break, but can you first give us a little sense as to what Mass was like at your church on Sunday?
Sure. I also witnessed an unprecedented situation at Mass for the first time in my life as a Catholic after the homily was given, and it was a very strong homily, really decrying the horrors of what's been exposed in Pennsylvania. A father toward the front of church actually stood up, and after the priest had concluded by really, you know, calling for comprehensive structural reform in the church, a father stood up and said, "How? How is that possible? How do we do that?"
Susan Reynolds, that is the core question, and we're going to take it up when we come back from the break. We're talking about another reckoning in the Catholic Church over clergy sex abuse and what it will take, that question, how to effect real, lasting, and permanent change in such an ancient and global institution. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply, based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about another reckoning in the Catholic Church over what to do about clergy sex abuse. This is following Pope Francis's letter to the worldwide Catholic community on Monday and last week's grand jury report from Pennsylvania detailing decades of horrific abuse there and systemic cover-up by many powerful people in the Pennsylvania Church. I'm joined today by Susan Reynolds. She's a professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology and lead author on an open letter to from Catholic theologians, parishioners, and more, calling on all U.S. bishops to offer their resignation in the wake of that grand jury report from Pennsylvania. Susan Reynolds, before the break, you were telling us about Mass on Sunday and what you witnessed, and you were telling us that a father at the front of the church stood up and said what?
Mm-hmm. He said, "How?
Yeah.
You know, how do we make this change? You're calling for change, Father, and I agree with you, but how do we do that?" And instead of, you know, dismissing him or saying, please sit down or we can talk about this later, the priest turned around and offered an answer to his question. You know, it was a faltering answer. It was an attempt. And in some way, it sort of exposed the inadequacy of every possible answer. But the important thing was that that man's voice was heard, this sort of prophetic, interruptive voice echoed within the walls of the church and in some way spoke for all of us there. It was a profound encounter.
A profound encounter for that moment. But you, in your open letter, are calling for so much more. You're calling for the U.S. bishops to follow the example set by Chilean bishops and all resign. I mean, you heard Phil Puella a little earlier in the show saying that would be hundreds of bishops in the United States and would effectively crater the American Catholic Church.
Well, what we're calling for in the letter is, well, the letter is first and foremost, I should say, a statement of solidarity yeah. with the victims and with their families, and to the U.S. Catholic bishops, an urgent call to prayer and action, right? What we call for is for the bishops to prayerfully and genuinely consider submitting their collective resignation to Pope Francis as a public act of repentance and lament before God and God's people. In the case of Chile, Pope Francis accepted three of mm-hmm. those 34 resignations. We have no expectation that Pope Francis would accept necessarily every single resignation that was offered.
Yeah. Just, however, I'm seeing that if he accepted perhaps five of those resignations. But,
yes, I think yeah. there's been a couple more.
Yeah, okay. But as you were, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but as you were saying.
There's no expectation necessarily that every single resignation would be accepted. But what it would show and what it showed in Chile is the sense of collective culpability and responsibility to which Pope Francis points in that powerful letter that he released yesterday that you read at the top of the hour. He says in very, very clear and sorrowful language, we abandoned the little ones. We did this. We failed. He calls for a solidaristic response from all the faithful. In the letter, he calls for collective penance. He calls for fasting and prayer on the part of all Catholics. Mm. However, that also begs the question, right? What does solidarity and accountability look like?
Right. And so let me ask you about that, because in all honesty, I'm not a member of the church. So the eyes that I read with are, albeit a secular one. Mm-hmm. But when Francis is talking about the great body of the global Catholic Church, and saying that everyone needs to be involved in the healing and fixing and accountability of the church, I mean, but the lay people aren't the one who've done this, right? I didn't see necessarily in the letter any specific language of Francis saying leadership of the church, the men in the Vatican who serve underneath him, that they are the ones who have to begin changing, modernizing, and holding themselves and bishops accountable.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that that was the weakness of the letter, and that was a weakness, I would say, that's been observed by many people. Of course, we all need to do our part in making sure that this never happens again. And it would be naive of us to believe that there was no lay culpability at all in any of those circumstances. Of course, it's not only the priests, it's not only the bishops. In some way, it's anyone who holds a position of power within the church who perhaps can examine their own complicity in upholding these structures of secrecy. However, the way in which power is held, the way in which power operates, particularly in this very clericalist paradigm that we're operating under, unfortunately, in the Catholic Church at this moment, calls us to recognize that power is wielded more than others, power among certain groups of people, particularly those in positions of ordained power, particularly yeah. bishops, is wielded in a very, very pronounced way. Right. And what the letter was missing was precisely that recognition.
Right. So, I mean, prayer and fasting may cleanse an individual soul or conscience, but it does nothing to repair an institution where power is held in the hands of really specific people. I mean, we've got a lot of comments coming in on this. On Twitter, D. Keefe, or Kieft, D, I'm sorry if I said your name incorrectly, but D says, I left the church years ago as I found their denials of abuse appalling. The church needs a massive overhaul, which should include bringing in more women and possibly allowing priest to marry. On our website, onpointradio.org, DFG says, in the flurry of outrage, it might be good to also recognize that while this abuse was happening, the Roman Catholic Church does a lot of good, too. For every abusive act, there are probably thousands of unnoticed and forgotten acts of clergy taking care of the hungry, sick, and forgotten around the world. Let's get a couple calls in here really quickly. Dana is calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Dana.
Thank you. Hi, Megha. I think simply this conversation misses the point. The scope of this is not just about what the church will do and the Pope and what he writes in a letter. It's what are individuals doing? How can they stay in an organization where the basic trust must be gone? And the basic tenets of their beliefs are shaken to the core. I don't understand. The focus should be on not just what the Pope writes in a letter, but how are people reacting to something that is this horrific and going on for so long?
Dana, thank you so much for your call. Susan Reynolds, let me turn that question to you. I mean, obviously, we're based here in Boston. We've had many conversations around clergy sex abuse here. And this is one question I have asked people over the years. We've had revelation after revelation. I mean, at what point, apropos to Dana's question, do you leave the church?
I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking themselves. Theologically, when we speak of the church, we're not talking about the institution. We're not talking about the hierarchy. We're not talking about a place. We're talking about the people of God. And I think that's where the question gets complicated. Those of us who have remained Catholic in the wake of these horrors, I think, are propelled by this recognition that the church at its essence is the people of God. And what the church is called to do at this moment, if the Catholic Church is going to continue to be in any way a life-giving institution, is to throw open the windows and doors and to empower lay people in a way that is structural and important and significant.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Susan. I mean, but it's such an interesting thought that I want to actually use it as an opportunity to introduce our other guest here who's with us today. Susan Reynolds, stand by for a second. Susan is a professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. And joining me now in the studio is Thomas Groom. He's professor of theology and religious education at Boston College and former director of the college's 21st Century Center there. Thomas Groom, welcome to you.
Thank you, Megan.
So, you know, pick up on what Susan just said there about the church needing to recognize that Catholicism, the Catholic Church, is this global body of people and perhaps, you know, throw open the doors of power.
Sure. No, we have to go in this direction. And I mean, I do think that this letter from the Pope, Megan, is a step forward. I think it's a breakthrough. I think Francis went through a conversion moment with his experience in Chile and the mistake he made in defending Barros and so on. I think he entered into a new moment and in a sense came out and apologized and so on and recognized that he had made a mistake. So hopefully we're moving toward better times. Now, I think many of the
How
points...
How long can that hope persist, though?
Well, I mean, this is very good. And your question to Susan, my friend, about how does people hang in? I think people hang in because they think that this faith is still life-giving. They still see the values and the gospel taught by Jesus of Nazareth as a wonderful life-giving way, a wise way, an ethical way, an enriching way to live one's life. Now, there's a great line in John's Gospel where Jesus says, the truth will set you free. So in a sense, coming to know this horrible truth, even though it's disastrous, it's abominable, it's reprehensible, at least it's the beginnings of a turning point that we might be able to face into what needs to be done. Now, I think Susan's comments are very apropos. I mean, how do we go about doing that is a powerful question. And I want to go deeper than that. Why? Why was this happening? And I think, again, Francis's letter is the beginnings of a response to that when he begins to talk about clericalism.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because that's a part that unless you're very familiar with Catholic tradition and even the language, papal language, it's a little confusing because he says clericalism, whether fostered by priests themselves or layperson, leads to an excision in the ecclesial body that supports and helps to perpetuate many of the evils that we are condemning today. And then he says, to say no to abuse is to say an emphatic no to all forms of clericalism.
Yes.
What does he mean?
Oh, it's difficult. You know it when you see it, Megan, but it's very difficult to define. But one of the things it means is an exaggerated power, a pedestal, a certain deference, preference for the ordained person over the baptized person. So in a sense, it magnifies the power of the priest and it minimizes the power of the laity. And what with that type of circumstance, then we'll never get to real reform, to the kind of institutional reform, not just repentance and prayer and so on, which are important for conversion, as you just said, but to real reform has to come when there's real lay participation. And I would want to emphasize especially the role of women in the leadership of the church, which we don't have now. The difficulty is that ordination is the first step. It's the first rung of the ladder. And if you're not ordained, you don't get to the first rung of the ladder. Baptism should be the first rung of the ladder for us.
But Thomas Groom, can I just jump in here for a second? Because that exaggeration of power that you're talking about between the ordained and the laity, isn't that a fundamental relationship in the church? I mean, it sounds like you're describing how the church is constructed.
Well, if it was just simply a relationship of people in leadership and people who are the general members of the church, that could be okay. But Catholics have a certain sense that there's an ontological difference between priests and lay people, as if there's something to the priest's very being that makes them closer to God and like unto God more so than the baptized.
Doesn't that come from a millennia of tradition?
Well, it comes from a millennia of tradition, but maybe it's not a very good tradition.
Yeah, I'm not justifying it, but I'm saying that it's core to Catholicism.
It's core after the Council of Trent. I mean, if the Catholicism is 2,000 years old, it becomes tremendously important after the Council of Trent, because in many ways, not to get too far afield here, but Luther and the Reformers had emphasized the priesthood of all believers. And the more the Reformers emphasized the priesthood of all believers, the more Catholics emphasized the ontological priesthood of the ordained. So in a sense, we both came away from that era with an inflated sense, at least Catholics did, of the role of priests.
Thomas Groom, stand by. Susan Reynolds, I want to get to you. And listeners, there's a lot of callers, and I promise I'm going to get to you. But Susan Reynolds, I hear what Thomas Groom is saying. But this, I mean, to me, it keeps getting to this core challenge that the church is talking about. I mean, he was talking about the Reformation just now, right? So that's what, 16th century. We're still talking about hundreds of years of attitudes and structures and practices and traditions that the church has practiced that... at least Francis is talking about it now, but it gets me thinking, how do you change? We've got the why, but how do you change things that are so deeply ingrained into what Catholicism is?
That's a great question. There are a few things that need to happen first. First, I think we need a wholly independent state-run investigation to take place in every diocese or ecclesiastical province all over the country, akin to the one that happened in Pennsylvania. You can't have structural conversion, you can't have individual conversion without truth-telling. And at this point, I think that the thing that's most needed is simple truth-telling. We need the truth to come to light so that it can set us free. Relatedly, there needs to be an elimination of the statutes of limitations which have prevented accountability and justice from being served. The existence of statutes of limitations are in part what have allowed bishops to be successful in covering up these crimes, right? If you shuffle a priest around long enough to basically run out the clock, so to speak, that essentially grants him impunity. And we know that this is precisely what's been done in Boston, in Pennsylvania, and in dioceses throughout the country. The third thing that we need very concretely is an observation that my colleague Andrew Prevo at Boston College noted in a recent online post, which is that we need to call for significant financial investment, he said, in independent research regarding the institutional and psychological and social factors contributing to this catastrophe. Because short of that, we'll continue to get this scapegoating that we've heard from so many sides, right? Scapegoating homosexuality or scapegoating or sort of referring to these crimes euphemistically as sins against chastity, right? Rape has nothing to do with chastity. Rape is about power and violence. So I think those three points specifically speak to the need for basic truth-telling so that the work of justice and reparation can proceed.
Right. And I mean, the problem is, as we've seen in report after report, that the church itself has resisted that basic truth telling for decades now.
Precisely.
And perhaps maybe that's changing, but it's not changing from within, as far as I can see, enough. But let's get to some callers here, because we've got a lot of people who want to join us. Ira is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Ira, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. What I would like to say is I believe that what we are witnessing is a total death and annihilation of the Catholic Church. I believe that is the only reaction and possible solution to the level of evil that is being presented, that's been going on for decades. And I also believe within a decade, not a single man or woman or child, anyone on earth, will refer to themselves as a Catholic. It's all over.
Ira, thank you so much for your call. Thomas Groom, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I don't agree with the caller. I respect their position and I can understand it, but I'm a very proud Catholic, not because of the institutional church and its failures, God knows, but because of the rich reservoir of truth, of wisdom, of spiritual wisdom, of ethics and so on that can be found still in this tradition. That my institutional church has failed miserably, not the whole people of God, as Susan defined the church earlier, which is the way to define it, but the leadership of our church has clearly lost the confidence of our people, and rightly so, and understandably so. And so I would be calling for tribunals that would investigate bishops that have been negligent, holding them accountable. I mean, we've got to go the next step. And I think the next step, in many ways, the Charter for the Protection of Children, of the Dallas Charter of 2002, was at least a step in the right direction. But it only referred basically to criminal priests who were committing these crimes. It did not refer or hold accountable the bishops that should have been supervising them, and in many ways, many times, simply transferring them. So the next step is to hold our bishops accountable, and I think that has to involve lay participation, that the bishops themselves are not capable or are not trusted at this point, like the last caller, are not trusted to police themselves. They'll have to be joined by the lay leadership as well.
Well, we are talking about yet another reckoning in the Catholic Church following last week's Pennsylvania grand jury report on decades of systemic abuse and cover-up there, and Pope Francis's letter to the worldwide Catholic community on Monday, an unprecedented letter. I'm joined today by Thomas Groom and Susan Reynolds. We'll get to a lot more callers after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news. Because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. Download the show, and we'll process everything together.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about another reckoning in the Catholic Church following last week's astounding Pennsylvania grand jury report documenting decades of systemic and oftentimes horrific abuse in Pennsylvania. That was followed on Monday by a letter from Pope Francis to the worldwide Catholic community saying that we abandoned the little ones. That's what the Pope said here. We're getting a lot of response from listeners. On Facebook, Terry Cruz said, I received an email from our pastor saying we need to pray and fast because of this scandal. I have to say I was really put off by that. I need to fast for the failures of church leaders, Terry asks. I don't think so. There are many good people in the church, but enough of this already. Now, we've got some tape here. Former two-term governor and attorney general of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, was on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher on Friday. She said something that many have said before her, that a couple of simple rule changes in her mind could end a culture of cover-up in what she called a culture of cover-up in the Catholic Church.
There is one way that is a surefire way of stopping this ridiculous cover-up and this tendency toward
what you're going to say.
And it
women
is
priests, right?
Get ordain women and let priests marry. That's it. Why are we covering this up?
Let's get to some callers here. Darlene is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air, Darlene.
Hi, Meghna. Yes, I would totally agree with that. There are very, very few pedophile women, and the church just seems to be inundated with them. I think they also need to clear their vaults of their immense wealth and spread it around, help the poor, and actually do some good for humanity. But the women priests are a must, and it's just a silly rule that they've had over the years about not having women priests, and that's all part of their plan.
Yeah. Darlene, thank you so much for your call. Susan Reynolds, professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. She's been with us this hour. Susan Reynolds, respond to that. We've been hearing it over and over again from lay people, from theologians like you, like Thomas Groom, who's with us, from many others. And yet the one place that I don't hear any active engagement with these ideas is at the Vatican itself.
Sure. Well, that's actually not a solution that you've heard from me. My own personal feelings on women's ordination aside, it's really important to note that women are not a magical solution to clericalism. The horrific reports that were brought to light out of Ireland in the case of the home for orphans in which hundreds and hundreds of children were buried, essentially, and other horrific acts committed by, you know, by women who've been protected by these structures of power make it very, very obvious that you know, women are not a magical balm. You don't just ordain women and suddenly all of these problems of clericalism and the hoarding of power go away.
But Susan Reynolds, if I may, perhaps the deeper point here is that the protection of masculine power by refusing the ordination of women is really at the heart of the matter. And point taken, it wouldn't be a magical balm, but it would be a huge opening up of those doors to power, wouldn't it be?
Well, you're exactly right to point to the role of this, I guess what you could call toxic masculinity in upholding this culture of secrecy. I think it's hard to look at the Pennsylvania report and see it as something other than almost a fraternity, you know, a boys' club, guys protecting guys, so to speak. It really is horrific. So I'm not, I don't mean to say that gender is an unimportant piece of the conversation. It absolutely is. I absolutely think that women need to be brought into positions of power and leadership within the church, lay, ordained, et cetera, women religious. In fact, women religious have provided some of the most prophetic leadership in the church and need to be listened to instead of investigated. But I think it's important to look not only at gender, but how power operates more broadly within the structure of the church.
Right. Thomas Groom, your thoughts?
Well, I think, Susan, it makes a lot of sense. The situation in Ireland, I think, was terribly complicated regarding the role of the religious women. But let me just set that aside for a moment. I do think that however the church is to move forward, it has to include, in real powers of leadership, the voices of women. Now, if the church is going to continue to refuse to ordain its women, which I think would be terribly unwise and theologically unsound, by the way, I think they would have to let the Pope appoint a dozen women cardinals and bring women into real leadership. I often said that if there had been a couple of grandmothers sitting around the table when these bishops were moving priests around from one parish to another, letting them commit the same crimes again, if there had been a couple of grandmothers in Cardinal Law's cabinet here in Boston, they would have spoken up. They would have objected. So it's not a panacea or a simple solution, God knows, but yet the total exclusion of women, because when you're excluded from ordination in the Catholic Church, you're excluded from real power and participation. The first rung of the ladder, as I said earlier, is to get yourself ordained. If you can't get yourself ordained, then in a sense, you live in the wilderness. Your voice is not heard. So that has to cease. This is the clericalism, though, that I believe Francis is finally pointing to. He's been pointing to it for some years, but this is a powerful statement saying this clericalism has to cease, and that lay people have to come into real leadership and voice in this church, and indeed the leadership of the church, bishops, etc., have to be held accountable.
Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air, Frank.
Hi, Magna. How are you today?
I'm well. What's your thought?
Glad to hear that. Well, I was a Catholic seminarian about 30 years ago. In fact, I completed the seminary, but I decided not to get ordained. I saw a lot of unholy behavior by the priests and the students. But the point I wanted to make is this. What I observed was, when the young men enter the seminary, they're rather humble and very devoted and dedicated. By the time they get ordained, a change in their mentality develops, and they seem to have the idea that they're above the law and they can do or say anything, and they become very misogynist. At least this was the case 30 years ago. And what I saw was the way they treated one another as they became closer to this, receiving these magical powers, as they used to refer to them, was horrible. Mm. At that time, at least, I don't know what it's like now, but back then, the seminaries were just private clubs for Catholic gays. That was pretty much what it was all about. And the priests who ran the place. They knew what was going on, and they promoted this sense that you're better than the rest.
Frank, if I may, your firsthand experience is absolutely fascinating, and I want to turn what you're saying back to Thomas Groom, because I should note that Thomas Groom, you're a former priest yourself. You left in order to get married, so for the best of reasons. But so, I mean, you have the seminarian experience. I mean,
yes, and what the former caller said, I mean, there's a lot of truth in it. I mean, I think the young people who entered an old Irish seminary with me and spent 6 years there in preparation and formation for priesthood were idealistic young people willing to give themselves to the preaching of the gospel and to the service of Jesus and so on. They were genuinely, I never met anybody who came into the seminary in my time, and there was hundreds who came in, you know, looking for an easy life or for what he calls, what, a private club for Catholic gays. I'd never encountered that in seminary. And yet, coming out of that seminary 6 years later, in the Irish context, there were people who indeed had been prepared for clericalism and for a clerical role and an inflated and exaggerated sense of their own importance and what have you. In many ways, they turned out clerics more than priests. Mm. To be servants of the servants, as it were. So that I think it calls in question, which is a whole other conversation, the whole structure of seminary formation, seminary preparation, the kind of people, how we're preparing people for priesthood, and which is another serious conversation that I think is the next one to come.
Susan Reynolds, let me turn back to you. And Thomas Groom, I want to ask the same question of you. Over the past many years, I've had a number of conversations with James Carroll, who both of you, I'm sure, know very well, a former priest himself, a great thinker and writer, sort of, I would call him a loyal critic of the church. And he repeatedly tells me, Susan, that you have to look at the church as an institution that operates on the timescales of centuries and millennia. And that, you know, it's not outlandish to look back to the fourth century, for example, right? To all the way back to Nicaea, where church leaders allied themselves with Constantine and became a powerful political institutional force. That the roots of the power structures that have led to these decades and who knows even centuries of abuse go back that far. And if so, first of all, what do you think of that? And if so, what does it mean for affecting change today?
That's a great question. I think he's absolutely right. The very, very complicated and often very destructive relationship between the church and imperial powers, state powers, secular powers is one that I think is very, very consequential for how we understand the way in which people view their own power within the church, the way in which lay people view the church, in which church leaders view their own accountability or lack thereof today. He's wise to return to Constantine. I think as a root of this very, very complex relationship of power that the church has existed in for centuries and centuries now, I think, you know, the only possible solution then is to return even farther, right? To retrieve, in a sense, the praxis of Jesus himself, who, you know, as God incarnate was born into the world, into a highly unusual family situation, on the margins of society, under the thumb of empire, and built his community, with the lowly, with the marginalized, with the victims, with the prostitutes and the tax collectors and the outcasts, and indeed was crucified among those very outcasts, and then rose and appeared not to the kings and the princes, but rather to his friends in quiet, intimate encounters, to women, I think it's this moment of reckoning for the church to return to ourselves, in a sense, to say, you know, how can we become more authentically Christ-like, not only as individual people in our own spiritual practice, not only in our parishes, but also at the very, very roots of our power structure.
Thomas Groom, your thoughts?
Well, the beautiful faith that Susan has just so well articulated is absolutely ours as Catholic Christians, and it can be that type of life-giving resource to us along the journey of life. I don't think we've got thousands of years to settle this problem. I think there was a time when the church could move slowly, but it was long before we had internet or that we had Magna Chakrabarty on point talking about this. So in other words, the communications media of our time has made everybody aware of this, and so we don't have a lot of time to put this right. It has to be done very, very soon. Or else, indeed, the kind of falling away and falling off of the of Catholicism, it'll be the demise.
Well, as we're seeing in Ireland, where the Pope is going this weekend. Yeah. I mean, I was looking back at the 2009 report that the Irish government put out about abuse in Ireland. And then, regarding the Dublin Archdiocese, the government's report said the Archdiocese's preoccupations in dealing with cases of child sex abuse, at least until the mid-90s, were the maintenance of secrecy, the avoidance of scandal, the protection of the reputation of the church. The welfare of children, which should have been the first priority, was not even a factor to be considered in the early stages. And that's from Ireland in 2009. And look what's happened there.
Yes,
church attendance has plummeted.
Yes, there's parishes in Dublin that have dropped from 70% to 8 or 10% attendance on a Sunday. And I've more than a passing interest in the Irish situation, obviously, given my brogue. My hope is that Francis may be able to do and say something in Ireland that can turn this around. Desperately needs to do so.
I want to get one more call here. Michael is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi, Magna. A quick point here. I was incested by a brother who had been in a seminary in the 60s. In the late 80s, I went up to his seminary to investigate this. Went to Washington to investigate it with some of his roommates. The denial was so thick then in the 80s. I think what we're seeing now is the tip of the iceberg. We're talking about priests and in the community. This goes way back. We have it in, and Frank makes a good point about the seminary, your previous caller. Mm-hmm. So to do systemic reform, when in fact so much of this is yet to come out, I think would be debilitating, not just for the institution, but for the voices of the many people that have been victimized here. And I do believe that the greater sin, if you will, was the cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
There's always the violation and the institutional response to it.
Right.
And until there's some accountability, but I don't think we can have that kind of accountability until we know the depth of this issue.
Right.
And I think what we've seen, two states,
right.
Massachusetts
and Pennsylvania,
and now Pennsylvania, we got 48 states to go. We've got seminaries. I think we're really at the front end of this crisis. Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your call. Susan Reynolds, Michael is touching on something that you said a little earlier in the hour, that if the accountability can't come, and I hope I'm paraphrasing this correctly, but if the accountability so far can't come from within the church, that it has to come from outside the church, possibly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And again, I think it must come from outside the church. Part of one piece of so many parts of this crisis of trust, very justifiable crisis of trust that people have in the leaders of the Catholic Church and the church in general, is the fact of, this deep skepticism that people very rightly have of this desire among church leaders to police themselves, right? Internal investigations, et cetera. It's been very obvious, I think, to all involved that this kind of internal investigation is not going to be sufficient for the work of truth-telling. The caller is also right to point to the vital role of seminary formation in contributing to this clerical culture. Again, this is something that has to be looked at from the outside, from the inside, from all possible angles, beginning with independent investigations.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas Groom, we've got 30 seconds left to go, so last thought to you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope that we have reached a turning point and that there will be real action at this stage. There'll simply have to be. And I think it's hopeful that the civil society, that the state or the Royal Commission in Australia is getting involved, because I think the state has to hold the church accountable, because tragically, it looks as if the church is not capable of holding itself accountable.
Well, Thomas Groom is professor of theology and religious education at Boston College and former director of the college's 21st Century Center. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Magna.
And Susan Reynolds, professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. She was lead author of an open letter from Catholic theologians, parishioners, and lay leaders calling on all U.S. bishops to offer their resignation in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury's report. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Susan Reynolds, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
And one last comment from our website, On Point Radio. And Steph says, any kind of sexual exploitation of children is horrific, no matter the perpetrator. But when it is done by religious leaders who are meanwhile telling their flock how to lead their lives, the utter hypocrisy adds to the approbation and scrutiny that they deserve. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.